time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis, and we start with the Chicago connection to the sad events of November of 1963. Anna?
Mm. Yeah, 1963, this week, we talked about Orion announcing JFK had been shot on WGN Radio last week in 1963. Well, this week, native Chicagoan Jack Ruby made international news, Bob, when he shot Lee Harvey Oswald, President Kennedy's assassin, in the basement of the Dallas Police Headquarters. That shooting was broadcast live on national television, making it one of the most widely seen murders in history. This nation was still coming to grips with the fact the president had been assassinated days before. Now people were trying to understand the motive of the assassin, and now the assassin's assassin. And Jack Ruby's history and life in Chicago came into the center of the national conversation. He was, of course, he came from Chicago. He was born in the Maxwell Street neighborhood, one of eight kids, mostly raised by his mother. He had a troubled life, was in and out of juvenile detention for petty street crimes. He ran muscle for some mob-related nightclubs. And at the time this whole thing happened, Jack Ruby was a nightclub owner in Dallas when he actually conducted it. But a lot of people asked, well, was he connected to the Chicago mob? Did the Chicago mob make him do it? And his brother, Earl Warren, a West Rogers Park native for many, many years, until his death a few years ago, gave interviews about his brother's involvement. And he also testified before the Warren Commission, which found that Ruby acted alone and not as a conduit for the mob. And we pulled a clip from brother Earl Ruby's testimony.
Interesting. Don't know if I ever heard that before.
No, interesting audio for sure. The family's contention all along was, yep, he did it by himself and acted alone. Of course, Jack Ruby died of advanced stage cancer, never really lived much longer, putting an end to his life. But Bob, of course, not the speculation or the many, many theories, you know, about what happened back then.
It'll never end. Back to this week, 1953. In a Hyde Park apartment, that's where this empire started, right?
This is incredible, just to think about this. 1953, Chicagoan Hugh Hefner, U of I grad, launched Playboy magazine from his Chicago apartment right on his kitchen table. He had his typewriter, and he was typing up all the stories that you saw in Playboy magazine. He was a writer, an English major, and featured a then-unpublished photo of Marilyn Monroe on the cover, Bob, a photo he bought from a suburban Chicago calendar company. So all kind of tied in together, and boom, Marilyn was on the cover. He bought the rights, and that was it. Sold the first issue for 50 cents. He did not put a date on that first issue because he didn't think he'd have enough money to scrape together to put together a second issue. So he borrowed money from his mom. He sold furniture to fund that one, but instead, it was a huge hit. It sold out, and a few short years later, he was selling a million copies a month. By 1971, 7 million copies a month, and of course, it wasn't universally embraced by everyone. Hefner was arrested, many people forget, for promoting obscene literature. That trial ended in a hung jury in 1963. And publicly, a lot of people praised him for promoting the sexual liberation and free speech. Others criticized him for profiting off the objectification of women. One thing's clear, though. Hugh Hefner always said and gave many interviews, including this clip we're going to bring to you here, that it was his repressed Midwestern household upbringing that made him, that led him to produce Playboy. And here he is talking to Bryant Gumbel on the Today Show about that.
And I feel like putting on my bathrobe and smoking a pipe now.
I know, really. Get your smoking jacket out, Bob, and your slippers, your fancy slippers, and here you go. The Playboy Club, I don't know if you ever went there. That opened in 1960, of course. His whole empire was based in Chicago for many, many years before moving it to L.A. True story, I actually applied to be an assistant writer while in Northwestern for some job they had open when I was at Northwestern at Medill, and didn't get the job, but it was interesting to check out the headquarters at that time.
Yeah.
Pretty fancy office.
We're on East Walton. Radioactive, this week in 1942, the University of Chicago was a little radioactive, wasn't it, Anna?
It could have been even more than it was, Bob. This is an important day in history, no matter where you are, but for Chicago, hugely important. It was a day that truly altered the course of human history, and it happened somewhat oddly in a cavernous basement below the grandstands of the University of Chicago football stadium, Stagg Field. World War II was underway. 1942, the race was on to develop an atom bomb. It was believed that Germany was getting dangerously close. But Enrico Fermi and his team of physicists were working around the clock at the UFC on a, well, originally in Manhattan, because it was called the Manhattan Project. That's where it started. But he moved his team to the University of Chicago, and that's where they changed the world, literally. Their lab at the Argonne facility was not yet complete. They conducted their experiments there in this makeshift lab under the football stadium stands at the UFC. And on December 2nd, 1942, Bob, that team held their collective breath and watched as they tested the nuclear pile, knowing there could be an explosion or a radioactive leak. So many things could go wrong. That test lasted 4.5 minutes, and of course, it worked. It was the first self-sustaining nuclear reaction, and that moment marked the birth of the nuclear age in the world. It truly altered the course of human history. As these UFC scholars point out, we pulled a clip here, Bob, from a documentary produced by the UFC a few years back, reflecting on the significance of that moment in time.
They weren't sure what would happen when they set that off, were they?
Yeah, it wasn't clear what would happen. They just knew they wanted to be first. And Enrico Fermi himself knew the great power of what he was creating and how it could be used for good and for evil. He had written a letter to President Roosevelt delivered by Albert Einstein saying, you know, warning of the nature of what they were creating and the hopes that they would get it done before the Germans did. So just a lot of history there to absorb. Just that UFC documentary is super awesome if anyone wants to just dig into that piece of history.
Yeah, very, very historic. Well, this time of year, 1987, we were still in mourning around here, weren't we?
Mayor Harold Washington died in office. So shocking, Bob, as you'll recall, 1987. He was on the fifth floor of City Hall, his office, having budget meetings, and he slumped forward at his desk, passed out, collapsed to the floor, and was pronounced dead a few hours later of a blood clot. He was a Chicagoan through and through, born in Brownsville. His father was a politician, a lawyer, and a preacher. Washington himself had a law degree from Northwestern. And we pulled a great clip here of Mayor Washington that you'll appreciate, Bob. I really like this one. It was his first term in office, April 1984. Mayor Washington was the very first guest on WTTW's Chicago Tonight, which I know you have a long history with. John Calaway asked the new mayor, even though he didn't know he would only have 3 more years to live, what do you hope your legacy will be? Here's what he said.
I used to love hearing him talk. He had a way with words. He could really turn a phrase, couldn't he?
No question.
A lot of people talking about the HBO documentary on the Super Bowl Shuffle, and it happened, December 7th, 1985, right?
Yeah. Have you seen the HBO documentary yet, Bob?
Not yet, but I want to watch it.
It's super fun. It's fun to see here how the players' reaction to what they signed up for, because it's clear they kind of didn't really know. They just knew they were doing something for needy families, and it was a fun song they were creating, so they had to show up at the Park West the day after their loss to Miami, the only loss of the season, a walloping on Monday Night Football. And they're kind of showing up there, and they're like, oh, we're going to dance, so we're going to do a rap. Oh, what are our lyrics? What are we going to sing? And it was just funny to see, because even Jim McMahon, who famously didn't go because he was that guy. He was unreliable. You know, sort of just didn't. He did his own thing, right? And he also had a big loss that he was coming off of, so didn't show up. They had to shoot his part at Hallis Hall, and he talks about how the first time he's ever heard of himself being called the Punky QB was when he was handed that script for his part. So it's just kind of funny to think about the way they were going through it. But of course, the Bears weren't doing it because they're greedy. They were doing it to feed the needy. Do we have time for the Willie Gault clip here?
Not really.
Let's skip it. But the interesting part, Bob, that I thought that I didn't know, and maybe you did, but Willie Gault, instrumental in putting the whole thing together. And he knew the music producer, Dick Meyer, and kind of was just behind the scenes working it. So
maybe,
pretty cool.
Maybe there will be a new version of it shirtless. You know what I mean?
I just hope so. I hope so. We got the makings of it coming.
And it's on HBO Max. Thank you, Anna. I'll talk to you next Wednesday.
Thanks.